Well, good afternoon. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you to the organizers of this conference, to the university, and all of you for having me here. It's a tremendous honor to be here and to be a part of this. And as Rajan mentioned, I've been here before. And as I was preparing to come, I knew, or at least expected, because this is how it went the last time, that I would learn at least as much, probably a lot more than I could possibly impart. And certainly the panel we just witnessed and some of the other conversations I've had were testimony to that. That was a tremendous informative and passionate experience to be a part of. And so thanks to all the other speakers as well. And I kind of suspected this would be the case, because the last time I was here, there was a panel of mainly farmers up talking about ecology and sustainability and the food system, and I was completely blown away and wasn't sure what I even would have to add to a conversation like that. I even actually wound up writing a magazine piece for a magazine called The Walrus that used one of the people, Jan Slomp, who I met on that panel, and I got to visit his farm and drink milk, more or less direct from his cows, and see, not literally direct, that would be a little odd. So I knew I was going to learn a lot, and I also knew if I was going to come here and speak to the question of a land ethic, that I would have a pretty tough act to follow, whoever it was that I met here, and that I should probably stick to the things I knew best. I'm not, directly involved in agriculture. I'm not someone who can speak so much to that sort of hands-on day-to-day stewardship. But I wanted to talk about how you talk about expanding it, how you expand some of these ideas of stewardship far beyond the land itself to the places where a lot of us live. And so when I think about my own land ethic, if you will, it focuses on basically two ideas, two terms, and that is climate change and cities. And I began the journey that wound up, resulting in the books that I've written with the first piece of that, which is climate change. And pretty much from the first time I spoke as a journalist to a climate scientist, as it happens, a climate scientist by the name of Andrew Weaver, who was just elected the first ever Green MLA in the British Columbia legislature this year. So Andrew's gone on to some pretty impressive things himself. But I knew from the moment I spoke to him and heard how climate scientists actually talk about the problem of climate change that what it was essentially an existential threat pretty much to the whole civilization project. As noble and passionate and beautiful as some of our conservation and stewardship projects had been to that date, climate change brought all of it into question. It cannot be contained by fences. It cannot be parceled off into parkland or into any kind of wilderness outside of human experience. It affects every single person on Earth, every single inch of land on Earth, every drop of water in the sea, every single thing that lives is threatened, or at the very least compelled to respond to the climate threat. So that's where I sort of began my exploration of what it would mean to live ecologically, sustainably, with a good land ethic, if you will, in this era of climate change. It brought me inexorably, seemingly unintentionally, to the question of cities. More than half of us live in cities now on this planet. There are 7 billion of us. There is, really no returning all of us to the land at this point. We will have to make our future in very, very dense urban habitat, most of us. Something like 80% of us by mid-century will be living in cities, by which point we need to have eliminated nearly all the greenhouse gases from the way we live day to day if we intend to hand on to our children and grandchildren anything like the kind of prosperity and the kind of healthy environment we've known. Where I came to the cities, it was interesting listening to Brenda up here on the panel, and she said something that struck me as a great phrase about being unapologetically human. And I think for a lot of us, where we feel the greatest sense of home and warmth and comfort is often in natural environments and that sort of thing. But for me, a lot of those tend to be urban spaces, actually. And I was thinking as I was listening to that panel about a thing that happened. One of the very first things I did when I was researching the geography of hope was I went to Denmark. And I didn't really know what I was looking for, but I'd read that there was this island in Denmark where they had eliminated their carbon footprint. And I knew that was basically the grail we're all chasing still, is that we would eliminate, you know, basically all our greenhouse gases, remove fossil fuels from the central place they play in our lives at present. And I did eventually go to that island. It's an island called Tsamso. I describe it in some detail. It was an amazing experience, predominantly agrarian isle. You know, a lot of the folks from Tsamso would have had a lot in common with some of the folks who spoke here today. But along the way, I had a stopover in Copenhagen. And at that point, I had not given a lot of thought to cities and their role in this. But I had heard that Copenhagen had this thing. This is back in about 2005. Copenhagen had this free bike program where you could, you know, basically borrow a bike the same way you borrow a shopping cart. You'd pop the coin in and drive off and ride the bike around. And so I thought, well, I'll try that out. I've got, you know, a couple days in Copenhagen. I'll go down to the central train station, get myself a bike and you know, see how far I get before I get tired of it. And so I did, and I got on the bike, and I honestly don't remember a conscious thought. I just remember there was a big, you know, sort of strip of pavement that was clearly for bikes right next to the central station, and I just started riding and just sort of followed the flow, and it was right around, you know, rush hour. And Copenhagen, as it turned out, I didn't know at the time, is one of the world's great biking cities. More people bike there than in almost any other city, certain modern city on Earth. And I just followed the flow. And I found myself, you know, in this sort of mass of cycling humanity all past the, you know, the sort of royal buildings of downtown Copenhagen and then along the harbor front and went on this, you know, fantastic hour and a half bike tour of the city without ever intending, simply because bike infrastructure is so good in Copenhagen that it's just this joy to ride. And when I thought of the phrase unapologetically human, that's what it felt like to be part of this kind of living mass of humanity moving through the streets of Copenhagen. And so I wanted to start with that just to, almost as a tease, because we're going to get back to great cities, livable cities, and sustainability. But we need to start, I think, by acknowledging where we are. I think you've done a lot of that today, and so I thought I would offer my own little piece of that by talking about one of the great things about Copenhagen is that the average carbon footprint there for the average homeowner resident is 80% smaller than the average Canadian's. And that's really then, therefore, you know, the grail's already been achieved. There's already a city you can live in today full of healthy, happy humans with 80% less carbon footprint than us, so let's all go there. And I will take you there in a manner of speaking, but I think the first thing we have to do is acknowledge both the reality of our situation and the wisdom that got us there. And it was a kind of wisdom. And so what I'm going to do, perhaps incongruously, is begin by honoring the miracle of fossil fuel, which is, in fact, as natural as anything else we've ever dug out of the earth. It is ancient sunlight, ancient solar energy, compacted over millennia into the most extraordinary fuel sources that humanity's ever discovered. It was perfectly logical and natural that we came to be dependent on these fuel sources in the way that we have. We didn't quite know the genie we were letting out of that bottle, but it's perfectly understandable that when we started digging this stuff out of the earth, we decided to stick with it. This is the nature of our problem. This is, you know, basically the fundamental relationship really we've had with energy for most of the time that we you know, have been alive on this planet, particularly in the Industrial Revolution and ever since, has been that you go out, you find mainly fossil fuels, you burn them, you make energy, you do stuff, and then you deal or don't deal with the consequences. And this is a great example of it. This is a, you know, typical coal-fired power plant. This is one of the power plants that provides the vast majority of our energy here in our electricity, sorry, here in Alberta. Coal, natural gas, and oil provide more than 80% of all the energy we use on this planet. We got here 7 billion strong in this highly technological society on the puffs of smoke out of fossil fuel smokestacks. That's how we came to be where we are. And it, as maddening as it might seem now that we know the consequences, it was a perfectly logical series of events that began with the extraordinary increase in the amount of work you could do with fossil fuel. This is where we began. We began with steam engines, turbines. They were so extraordinary in the 19th century that, you know, you could put one, as in this drawing, at an exhibition just to say, hey, wow, look what we can do now. I mean, it was just so extraordinary. Everything that had been done on the planet by people to that point had been at human scale, either the scale of what you could move and lift and carry on your own or with the help of animals. But definitely nothing like what exploded out of the ground in the form of coal and oil and natural gas. You think about how, for example, we used to travel across the sea. In some cases, you could, enslave basically a galley full of rowers, and that was one way to cross the sea. Another way was to capture the wind through giant sails. You were very much at the mercy of where those winds were blowing and when and how strong. With the arrival of fossil fuels, you could put a handful of guys down in an engine room feeding coal into a steam engine and radically transform not only the pace by at which you could get from one place to another, but how much you could carry, how much work you could do. This was an extraordinary explosion in the amount of work we could do on the planet. And it's, again, perfectly understandable that this is where we move to as human societies, because this was, an incredibly liberating force for a lot of people to not have to do it all by hand, to not have to lift every barrel on your own. And one of the great symbols of that liberation was the invention of the internal combustion engine. And this is Henry Ford with his first V8 engine. And this was, quite understandably greeted as one of the great, sort of leaps forward for human society that we'd ever uncovered. Suddenly you as an individual, on a whim, could just get in this vehicle and hurtle across the earth at an extraordinary rate of speed, go anywhere you wanted. I mean, a lot of people to that point, through the 19th century, might never have left, walking distance from the place they were born. And there were some, really great benefits to that, but there was also a sense of limitation that was suddenly gone, and even more so once air travel and long-distance high-speed train travel came into the picture. Really a radical transformation of how people lived. And the other thing at the time that we tend to forget, I think, now, is how easy this stuff was to obtain as a fuel source. Oil, which, in a sense is kind of the king of this trinity of fossil fuels. If you've seen the film, There Will Be Blood, in the opening sequence of that film, the main character all but claws oil out of the earth with his hands. I mean, you could do it with human-scale tools, pickaxes, these sorts of things. You found a gusher. There was a huge reservoir of the stuff, incredibly dense, easy to transport, really, really powerful energy. All you had to do was essentially stick a straw in and then pump the stuff out of the ground. And so obviously, it trumped all other fuel sources. You go back to Henry Ford, he looked at a whole bunch of other fuel sources, other kinds of oils, things that had been, whale oil and things like that had been used for lamps. Biofuels were played around with at the time, but nothing could do what fossil oil could do. Nothing could do what hydrocarbons could do in terms of power and ease and the rest of it. And that was how we came to the place we now arrive. And we continue to perpetuate that system, in part because it was working so well for so long, in part because it's hard to imagine doing a lot of this stuff without this system, even though the scale of it has moved into an entirely other realm in terms of our relationship with the Earth. And this is where we now find this era of extreme energy, if you will. This is a very typical oil well today. This is a $100 million oil platform off the coast of Brazil. It is sitting in 5 miles of water. The straw, such as it is, goes down through 5 miles of water and then 5 miles of sand and salt and crust to reach the pool of oil that it is there to obtain, thus to maintain a global flow of somewhere between 86 and 90 million barrels a day, which is how we continue to enjoy all the fruits of this industrial society that we do. That's where we've ended up. And this, of course, is something we're well familiar with here in Alberta. It is, one of the great industries of the province. It is, the economic engine of the province, and the scale of it on our landscape is pretty extraordinary and can be quite shocking at first glance, and probably at second and third as well. The oil sands are a whole other level of magnitude to the oil. The oil extraction business, this is no longer something you could possibly do by hand. The management of it, the extraordinary engineering skill and ingenuity and might that it takes to do it is part of the reason why the province has prospered. It takes a lot of people and a lot of money and a lot of good work to do what we're doing in northern Alberta. And this has had an equally dramatic impact. I'm not going to get into the ecological cost of this, although it's extraordinary, but it's also had an extraordinary impact on how we use energy and how we live. And this is where I'm going to come back around to talking about cities and how we build cities in such a way that we no longer need the extreme oil that we currently do. If you go back to the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, this was urban scale. There's an English village, a good-sized English village in the mid-19th century. This was how cities looked and how they functioned. They were very much adjuncts to the rural economy, which was the actual driver, farms, and market towns, that kind of model. Again, very, very, cottage-ish in scale, if you will. Very, very quickly, within a couple of generations, the scale of urbanity was something else entirely. And I now look at this photo. It's interesting. This is New York City in 1900. This is Mulberry Street on the Lower East Side in 1900. And what I, at the time, this was considered a deeply undesirable place to be in a lot of ways. I now look at it, for reasons I'm going to come back to, as an extraordinary social experiment in teeming humanity. More than anything, what I want you to note as we move forward is that the street, Mulberry Street, is very clearly a multifunction public space. It is not an avenue for the egress of motor vehicles. And really, a lot of what we think of as this sort of modern technological civilization we now enjoy grew out of the kind of interactions and the incredible diversity of humanity, the biodiversity, in a sense, of humanity, that grew on the streets of cities like New York City. What happened, though, when the motor vehicle arrived, when the internal combustion engine arrived, was that extraordinary liberation in terms of speed of transit fundamentally rewrote the idea of what an urban street was, what an urban neighborhood was, to the point where the overwhelming majority of what we have built in terms of human habitation in Canada for the last 50 years follows basically this model. This is suburban Calgary, but you can find this exact same model on the edge of Wetaskiwin, I'm sure on the edge of Camrose, on basically anything larger than a village-scale community in Canada today, built basically on this model.